These days, good sense is in short supply. Amid the fear-mongering and fake news, it can be hard to take a breath and tune in to what's real. But every week, The Economist provides clarity on the issues that matter to you. Get a free print copy of The Economist. Text free copy to 78070 for a sensible, more considered view. Text free copy to 78070 now. The Economist. Clear thinking in an uncertain world. SMS charged as per tariff. New subscribers only. Further T's and C's apply. Visit economist.com/terms/specific offers for more details.
Hello, and thank you for joining me. My name is Gabriel Montoya, and this is the Undiscovered Country, Episode 2. We've been on a bit of a hiatus since our first episode, which was January 20th of 2017. I took some very personal time. My mother, after a long illness, passed in February at age 77. The mourning process, all of it, really just has its own timetable. That's life. Her death really brought up something that had already been on my mind, but it really brought it to the forefront. You'll understand as I go along here. This show's mission is to explore the undiscovered country. That is to say, the issues that surround us that we don't fully understand. I'm not a journalist on this show. People that are listening probably know me from the time I was a boxing writer, about 10 years' time, and really six of it concentrated in Los Angeles. In that time, I was known for being a serious researcher, a guy that would chase a story for years until he could get it told. We're going to set precedents with episodes as like this show and with the last show. We'll pick up those threads as we go along, but not every show is going to be on the same subject. On this show, I'm just a concerned citizen of this country who's lucky enough to have a friend and business partner in Dave DeWenis who was like, hey, make a podcast covering whatever subjects interest you. What do you feel passionate about? A subject, as I said earlier, that really came to the forefront of my mind during my mom's funeral and really all during her last days was the subject of immigration. My mother is from Villahermosa, Mexico. She came to this country, finally, properly, legally, I guess, to stay. She was 12. She'd come to this country previously. I think she was 9. They'd had a few close calls, La Migre, or immigration, showing up and asking questions. And luckily, they were able to give the right answers and stay or escape detection. It was a fear, a way of living in those early formative years that stayed with my mom all her life. She wouldn't set foot in Texas because of how poorly she was treated. Because she had a big family, and in those days it was, I think, easier to get across the border and more common people to come over and a work visa for a few days and then overstay it. I remember growing up with stories of her brothers who were much older than her going back and forth across the border to get to work, which was usually day labor, the kind of jobs that no one's really wanting to do, but you need the money, you're poor. So, for me, it's a personal issue. Depending on the years, the word immigration can have different meaning, different connotations. To some, it's a romantic connotation, the very thing that created this country, the beleaguered but scrappy immigrant who comes to the U.S. of A. in search of their American dream. Certainly, my mother was looking for that, or her mother, Candelaria, who brought her to this country hoping for her sisters mainly. They were still growing up, they were still young, her and her two sisters, my mom, that they would have a better life, My mom ended up becoming, let me back up. as I said, the word immigration can have different meanings, different connotations for different people. For me, I think of my mother. To Donald Trump, the word immigration conjures a different image.
When do we beat Mexico at the border? They're laughing at us, at our stupidity. And now they're beating us economically. They are not our friend, believe me. But they're killing us economically. The U.S. has become a dumping ground for everybody else's problems. Thank you. It's true. And these are the best and the finest. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to border guards, and they tell us what we're getting. And it only makes common sense. It only makes common sense. They're sending us not the right people. It's coming from more than Mexico.
I'm an American of Mexican descent. That's what I consider myself. Now, what does that mean? It means my family was here when it was still Mexico. We have a cousin of mine that he's traced all our stuff back. Traces us back to Las Cruces, New Mexico, like 1787, when a child was born to a Montoya couple, which means we were here even longer than that. He just can't find the records. I'm also told, I think he found it, that our name is, the Montoya name is on Cortez's ship logs. Now, we haven't traced all the way to those folks, but that tells you how long my name goes in this country. The Montoya name comes from a tiny village in northern Spain called Montoya. So there you go. Now, on my mom's side, it's a little different. You know, my dad's side of the family, he'll joke, you know, we didn't cross the border crossed us. But on my mom's side, we have the Francos and the Orangas. My great-grandfather, Mucio Oranga, was the mayor of Chihuahua, the city of Chihuahua. He left his position to fight in Pancho Villa's army and was killed by Federales, who hung him in town. My grandmother, Candelaria, then a young woman, heard of her father's death from the newsies, barking out, "Extra, extra, Mucio Oranga has been hung," only in Spanish. Candelaria and her stepmother took the family, fled into the hills to hide. And one night, they heard a knock at the door of where they were hiding. At the door were soldiers, Pancho Villa's men, and among them was Pancho Villa himself. The revolutionary leader gave Candelaria a sack of money as payment for the loss of their father. "Start a business. You will be safe," he told her. They opened a general store, I'm told, and Villa is said to have helped my grandmother secure a teaching job like sometime thereafter. She would eventually marry a Franco and have a bunch of kids, I think like 5 boys and 3 girls. Among them was my mother. The girls were younger than the boys. My mom and her family first came to the U.S. when she was a young girl. After some close calls with immigration, they returned to Mexico when my mom was 9. She would return at age 12 with the proper paperwork and be naturalized sometime after becoming the first person in her family to graduate from high school. Now, throughout her life, until she passed this year at age 77, my mom always helped people new to this country. It was just in her bones. Those early years, those close calls, living in fear, being derided for the color of her skin and where she came from, when, you know, just a few generations back, her family was traveling back and forth freely all over this country that was still Mexico. And all that stayed with her. And so she always helped people. There would be, somebody working, doing the tile in our bathroom, that she'd be helping out, somebody new to the country that knew how to do that, or be a woman helping her with errands or cleaning around the house. My mom had a car crash in the late 70s when I was a kid, and she was never quite the same. Her back was kind of messed up, so she needed help. And so it kind of went both ways there. And that was her American dream, I think, was helping others get here, get some their feet under them, and realize their and actualize their American dream. It's really quite something to meet the people that she helped after she passed, have them thank me, and you know, just I didn't do anything, my mom did it, but you know, just wanting to impress on me how much she did for them. And so, you know, I look at what a dirty word it's become, immigration. And I think, I was thinking, you know, all through my mom's funeral, all through those services, my mom is not illegal. She was an asset to her community. She gave clothes and our toys, her time and money, anytime she could, whether it was through the church or other ways. And I just, this episode's for her. My experience with immigration is a personal one. It's part of my roots. But, you know, it's part of every American story, whether you were a native, a descendant of the first Europeans to come here, or the slaves brought here from Africa. But I'm not an expert on the subject, which is why this week I bring you an expert on the subject, Holly Cooper. So the first question, first off, just thank you for talking to me.
Yeah, no problem.
My mother was an immigrant, my late mother. She came over, you know, overstayed the visa when she was 9, stayed till she was 12, and then they went back. And I think they went through the proper channels and then were able to come over. So it's something I've lived with for a long time, hearing that phrase, illegal alien. And so I'm going to, I only have about 8 questions, but hopefully we'll touch on some of these things. And
okay.
So first off, just explain, you know, what it is that you do and how you got into it.
Okay, so currently I'm the co-director of the Immigration Law Clinic at UC Davis Law School, where we essentially, where the focus of my work is working with immigrants, both adults and children, who are detained by the federal government in immigration custody. And we take about, you know, 20 cases per year, where we use clients or the cases to help train students on how to become lawyers. And so it's kind of a lot like a medical residency where you're supervised by a doctor, but you're sort of in training. And so all of the students work under my supervision, but are talking in court, advocating in court, gathering evidence, putting witnesses on the stand, but they're doing it in an institutional academic setting where they're supervised by a lawyer. So that's the project that I currently run. And I got into this, you know, probably a reason similar to your own history, is that my grandfather was a refugee, and sort of that sort of vein running through my family history as well. And in addition, I grew up in a sort of in a rural area of Texas where I learned Spanish. And just throughout my life, you know, as a young individual, I was asked to translate or interpret, and I sort of grew up with this other level of understanding of what the immigrant communities were going through. And I think it sort of led me in a direction to sort of, you know, not initially anyway, but I was sort of always translating at the asylum interviews, you know, during the sanctuary movement, or, you know, working in some kind of capacity to assist. And I originally wanted to be a doctor, but I ended up, you know, going in this direction mainly because of all of the things that I witnessed weren't always positive ones, and that most people were losing their cases. And I really felt like, as a translator or a paralegal, that I really didn't have any say or any ability to assist, other than helping people construct their narratives. So that's how I kind of got involved in this. Was, I think, mainly my access point was my language skills. And then from there, it was just, you know, just the hearing the stories and just sort of wanting to take some, doing something more constructive with what I was hearing.
It is, it's a thing of a rabbit hole. And once you kind of go down it, you know, there's so many avenues there. I mean, I covered a story, I think, you know, with Alfredo Angulo several years ago, a boxer that got deported and then he tried to get back in. And it turned out that the story was not unusual, the way he was stuck, you know, trying to get asylum and stuck in there. But it's, one of the things, I read something recently that really struck me. It said that, you know, immigrant and refugee stories need to be understood as war stories, that they're coming here not to take our jobs, but to find a better place. And usually those places have been torn apart by by war. Can you talk about maybe just some of the misconceptions about immigration, you know, that and the people that are trying to come here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the economic, you know, impact, I mean, all the studies that I've read, even ones that I've studied, where I've read, and they're coming from a pretty conservative angle, show that there's almost an nil of an impact on, you know, U.S.-born or naturalized citizens' ability to get work. I mean, the most, you know, even the most conservative study has just shown that it's like almost like, you know, 2 or 3%, right? We were talking about, in percentages of the U.S. population, which is in the billions, we're talking about a population that is in, like, the low millions, like in the, you know, around 11 million of undocumented workers. And so to kind of show that there's some sort of a negative impact on those individuals' ability to get work is very difficult to do on a statistical level. But it just hasn't shown. And in fact, the opposite has been shown, is that California, since like 82, has gone through a complete demographic shift. And so if we just look at California as an example, we have seen crime rates drop like significantly in the state of California when we've had a population shift that is one of majority minorities. And also we have 25% of the nation's immigrants in the state. About half of all children in the state live with at least one foreign-born parent. And we see, you know, if, you know, sort of the new administration's, you know, sort of, you know, apocalyptic views of what's going to happen when we have this kind of demographic, really the opposite has been shown to be true, is that we have crime, significant crime drops. We also have significant reduction in the rates of high school dropouts, and a significant, we are the largest economy within the United States, and I think we're, you know, like, I can't remember if it's the sixth, the fourth largest economy in the world, mm-hmm. That California is. So it's really like showing that immigrants are actually, you know, helping produce not only economically, but also socially with our education, with crime reduction. And so I don't know that, you know, all the negative stereotypes we're hearing just aren't panning out when one sits down to study the matter.
I remember in his first, you know, announcing his campaign, Trump said that, you know, Mexico is, they're not sending their best folks, you know, they're rapists, they're murderers. Some of them are good people. Is Mexico sending people over?
I mean, Mexico could. Like, I mean, yesterday I spent the whole day with the Mexican consulate, right? And they're sending over diplomats to work here. For sure, Mexico is sending people to work in the United States, either at the corporate level or through their, you know, their consul offices. But in terms of migration, no one is telling, you know, Mexico's not saying, hey, you know, citizens of Oaxaca, you should migrate to the United States. I mean, that's just obviously not happening.
Right.
In fact, it's beneficial for their economy to have people stay and develop, you know, industries. It's also beneficial, you know, to their economy to have, you know, remuneration sent from the United States, because the economic system that's developed between the United States and the United States is that there a significant percentage of their economy is based upon individuals who work here sending money home to contribute to the economy. But that's just sort of a historical development that is one that's made itself intertwined. But it's not to say that Mexico is sending people here because it's, you know, it's in their best interest. In fact, you know, most of the Mexicans, you know, the government or NGOs that I've met with really are advising people how dangerous, you know, to traverse the border is and whatnot. But you know, I mean, we'd be remiss to say that, like, there's not a single undocumented immigrant that hasn't committed a crime. And just like with any population, U.S. born or otherwise, there's going to be a percentage of people that will commit crimes, right?
Sure.
You can't say that this X community is crime free or that's not, or, you know. So, you know, so it's just unfortunate that, you know, we do have people, both citizens and non-citizens, who are committing crimes. But I think to tar brush an entire demographic, you know, like our Black communities or our Latino communities, because there have been incidents, is just really inaccurate. You know, to say that, you know, this person, you know, commits a crime, therefore we're going to tar brush the entire Muslim community, the entire Black community, when in fact, when you study it, it's your immigrants or people who are non-citizens are committing crimes at a much lower rate. Yet there's a disproportionate impact of people who are getting arrested, right, and profiling. So the fact that they're actually having lower crime incidences with respect to their demographic really says a lot, especially when they're being overly targeted with respect to their white counterparts.
You think he's conflating, it felt like a callback to like the Cuban crime wave, or Castro sent a bunch of people over, but also it's like he's conflating the drug war, people bringing over drugs from Mexico or from Central South America, with immigration and just kind of putting them all into the same boat in order to kind of push his message.
Yeah, it works, you know. So, it's tasked upon, you know, people like myself to educate my own community, you know, my own white community, to dispel all these myths because, you know, the rhetoric worked. And it's really just rooted in misinformation and hatred. And it's just, you know, once one actually reads and studies the matter, I mean, it just doesn't pan out that every Mexican citizen is a rapist or, you know, has a different type of propensity to commit a crime is just completely inaccurate. And it's very actually dangerous to put forth for our population that kind of information. So, and the same can go with, you know, take your minority population, the same could go with LGBT, that it's not productive to have the military, with Muslims have a higher propensity to, you know, commit terrorism. All of this rhetoric is very dangerous and puts our communities at risk.
Yeah, no question. You kind of answered this already, but do you think migrants hurt us or they help us? Do you think to have somebody from a different culture? I think people are so afraid of losing Western culture or in some cases white culture. But do you think it enriches us to have different people from different walks of life here?
I think just taking language, for example, when you have capacity, dual language capacity, you're testing at a higher level. So there's a greater brain capacity where individuals are using both languages. Both my children were raised to be bilingual, and you know, that's panned out. They've done very well in school. And also, I think your ability to have compassion when you learn a different language is increased because you're communicating with people on a very direct level. I think that, you know, what is white culture? And, you know,
right.
I mean, a lot of the origins of white culture, you know, are brought forth from, you know, West Africa. You know, we're already a culture, whether we recognize it or not, of mixed cultural backgrounds. It's just whether we co-opt those and sort of, you know, go back and retranscribe history to co-opt those as being owned by whites. I think it's very inaccurate. I mean, our history was founded upon, you know, in part, you know, the exploitation of slaves to create this culture. And I think it's really a misconception of our own history to say that, like, what we've created, you know, we can claim it as a white only sort of claim. I don't think that is accurate. I mean, a lot of this, you know, most of this country's history, and California used to be part of, you know, Mexico.
Right.
Most of the United States did as well. I mean, it's a history that's intertwined with different races, and I mean, we do have some very dark periods of our own history, and nobody wants to claim those. But I think that I think it's enriched this country. In fact, you know, to have that kind of creativity. If you look at, like, you know, Apple computers or whatnot, there's, you know, founded by a refugee himself, or
son of,
you know,
yeah,
son of a refugee, exactly. So, you know, I think that this country has a long tradition of attracting immigrants, and I think the people who migrate have a tendency to be bigger risk takers. And those bigger risk takers mean that they're willing to do entrepreneurial ideas, to have innovation. And I think that it really helps us as a country to keep attracting that innovation and to attracting the type of people that are, you know, risk takers and the people that want to build something together. But, you know, unfortunately, there's a big divide in this country right now, and we hope that we can overcome that.
I'd read somewhere, and stats are always tough, especially in this era of multiple news sources, but that when Trump made that statement, that immigration, at least I think from Mexico, was at net zero, that people were coming.
Yeah, yes.
Is that true?
That's true. So there's been an attrition in migrants, like, you know, taking California as an example again, there's been an attrition in migrants. The biggest immigrant population now in the state of California for the last 5 years, at least. But this is up until 2015, because I don't think I have the statistics for 2016 yet, is like Asia is by far and large the biggest migration population into the state. And we're looking like India, the Philippines, and China as the top three countries. Latin America, there's been an enormous decrease in migration, you know, as well as Mexico, obviously. But we had a huge surge at our border about, I think it was like 4 years ago from the three countries within Latin America that were in the greatest turmoil, which was Guatemala, you know, Honduras, and El Salvador. And we've seen a significant decline in migration from those countries to the United States, as well as Mexico. And I think a lot of it is, you know, maybe the countries are stabilizing. Another part of it is that people, you know, are being treated like less than human once they arrive here. They're being detained. It's just not the land of dreams that they once thought it was. You know, in fact, I just had a kid tell me that the other day. He was a teenage kid, detained, and he's like, this is not the land that I thought it was going to be.
And my mom actually, she wouldn't go to Texas.
Yeah, well, I don't blame her.
Yeah, because of the way she was. I know you're from Texas, but, you know, I don't mean to trash your state, but.
No, go ahead.
I remember late in life, I didn't find this out until she passed, but that my dad had been up for a promotion. He'd worked in the post office. He was an executive later on in his career, and they were give him a huge promotion. My mom was like, I'm not going to Texas. And so he didn't take it just because of the way she'd been treated when she came over.
Yeah, kind of like the Thelma and Louise sort of narrative where they're like, she's like, I'm not driving through Texas.
Yeah, exactly.
Get to Mexico. They're like, wait a minute, what do you mean? But I mean, there is that kind of visceral reaction to Texas.
Yeah. I've actually yet to visit myself. You know, looking at this administration and the last one, I recall people calling President Obama or former President Obama the deporter in chief, and that he had deported, I think, more like something like 3 million people, more than any other administration. But what do you see, all that aside, what is the difference between that administration and this administration regarding immigration?
Yeah, that's a great question. The difference is the following. So Obama definitely had a very, very strict policy against women and children of detention. And I think it was rooted in deterrence. In other words, we were having a huge, you know, surge of migrants at our border from Central America. And the administration's thought was explicitly that, you know, if we detain the women and children coming to our borders, it'll it'll get back home to Honduras, like, don't come up north. It'll have a level of deterrence. So that is definitely staying true to this Trump administration, is that they're sort of have this policy of detaining women and children and hoping to continue this deterrence, which, you know, if you look at the numbers arriving at our border, maybe it has worked out that way, because they're definitely in stark decline. Some of the areas where it's different are who he's targeting, apart from the women and children, is that we're seeing people who under Obama would not have been targeted, generally speaking. Like, generally speaking, somebody with no crimes, with DACA status, wouldn't have been a target. You know, but for the most part, you know, and we also didn't see as many, like, home raids. Now we're starting to see a little bit more people arrested at home. And then there was the huge raid up in Detroit of all the Iraqis. Many, many Iraqis were involved. And we just didn't see sort of that style of enforcement of people with almost zero crimes being targeted, or people with DACA status at least had sort of an assurance under his administration they wouldn't be targeted. So I tell people, usually it's not the numbers that are changing, but it's kind of who's the priority has shifted somewhat.
It feels like they're going after, like legal immigrants and illegal immigrants, which I'm not crazy about that phrase, illegal immigration, but and getting people at churches and at schools, or dropping their kids off to school, the horror stories are kind of piling up. I'd like to talk a little bit about ICE detention centers, which I think is kind of one of our ugly secrets. I mean, when I saw Angulo, and he had long hair, he was fighting to get just a good pair of shoes. He had like China flats on that he said, you know, he tried to run in them, and it was so hot that he would burn through the soles really fast. are these for-profit prisons, and in some sense, kind of concentration camps in a way, the way they're packing people in? We've had, I think, almost 10 deaths, maybe 12 deaths in ICE detention this year.
So to kind of take those questions in turn, like the for-profit aspect and then just sort of the conditions issues inside of there. Like, one is that, yes, I mean, a significant percentage of ICE's contracts are with private prison companies. The two biggest ones are the GEO Group as well as CCA, both of whom have contracts even within the state of California to detain immigrants. One is in Bakersfield. It's run by the GEO Group. The other one's on the border down in Otay Mesa, which is close to San Diego, which is run by the Corrections Corporation of America. And both are, you know, profiting essentially from the detention or the caging of immigrants. And so obviously, if you think about, you know, your profit margin is increased the less services you provide, right? So, but the reality is sometimes, you know, that I think the facility you visited, was it in El Centro, my husband said?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, I think that that facility is one of the few that's actually owned and operated by the federal government. It's a certain processing center. And, you know, what's interesting is usually you have immigrants with more complaints in those facilities than you do in the private ones. Not to say that they're happy in either place.
Right.
But anyway, it is interesting. But, you know, nobody's advocating for privatization because of that, because there's still pretty miserable experiences in both places. So sort of like a competition to the bottom. But in terms of like the conditions, I mean, there's so many different experiences, but when you go into like a family detention center or a kids detention center, it definitely feels like an internment. I mean, maybe I wouldn't go far as a concentration camp, but it definitely feels like you're interning people based upon their racial identity. And it's really powerful because, especially when you see children in detention, it's just that there's not like a dry eye in the house once you're done doing individual intakes, because the experiences are so traumatic. And these aren't just kids that cross the border. These are kids who have been living in the United States their entire lives, right? That are undocumented and plucked off of our streets. And just to give you an example, like in Woodland, California, which is 10 miles north of here, you know, kids are being brought in from Long Island. Like, these are teenagers who are being brought in. They've lived here for years and years, and they're being plucked off the streets in Long Island, New York, and being brought to California for deportation. It's a very traumatic experience for a teenager to be plucked out of his community, out of his mother's home, and brought thousands of miles away where he has no daily contact with any of his family. And so it's not just like the conditions inside, which are horrific, but it's also just the real divestment of ripping a kid out of his community, away from his mom, and saying you can only talk to her now for 30 minutes a week is really, really traumatizing to take people out of the communities in that particular way.
And I wonder what's going to be the effect of taking people that have never been to a country that are, you know, from there, in a sense, like these teenagers, are going to deport them back to a country they've never been to.
What's going to be the effect on them,
and what's going to be the effect on that country?
Yeah, what's going to be the effect? And what's going to be the effect on their mothers? You know, it's really traumatic to experience that in one's family. Yeah, and I don't like the effect on the country. You know, a lot of when my clients have been deported, they've had a really positive impact on their country because a lot of them are bilingual, and they're really able to do very positive things. You know, I've just had a client who we actually ended up winning his case and getting him brought back in. But he was a human rights worker in Haiti, like helped after the earthquake, he fought for prisoner rights. He's an award-winning human rights advocate.
Wow.
Another client who was deported to El Salvador, who, you know, worked in a manager in a call center because, you know, U.S. exports a lot of their jobs abroad to work in these call centers. And a lot of the people working in the call centers are deportees because they're bilingual. And so, you know, a lot of the deportees with whom I worked have done really amazing things back in their home countries. And so, you know, that doesn't really help the narrative to help them stay in the country, but it just kind of shows you that people are capable of rehabilitation and redemption. And, you know, we can't just look at people, you know, with this really narrow lens, that people do have a lot to contribute to. And, you know, I think once they're given that opportunity, they really can sort of step forth and do that. And it's pretty.
That's amazing.
Like an untold story of the deportees, I think.
Well, that's definitely a thread. Maybe in the future we could connect. You could connect me to some folks. I'd love to tell that story.
It is interesting. Mm-hmm, sure.
Just last thing. How can the part of the mission of the show is to just shine a light on things that people aren't really quite looking at or they don't understand. You know, they hear the buzzwords and they have their kind of buzz opinion. But then the other part of it is to connect people in a way. How can they help? How can a regular listener or myself, just regular folks, how can we help this issue and help immigrants in need or organizations that help them?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's several things people can do, but I think the bottom line in this country is that we need to educate middle, upper middle class, like sort of white communities. And I think that, like, perhaps, like, you know, I've failed in that regard, and I'm starting to really transition. I mean, really, most of my career, I've sort of targeted education on impacted communities and letting them know their legal rights. But I think really what needs to be shaken in this country is a re-education of white people's understanding of, you know, immigrants and who they are. Because I think that that's really where the animosity is stemming from. And I really feel like it's misinformation. And the more we can do to educate, you know, that community and re-educate that community, I think the better, the closer we're going to be to healing in this country.
That's fantastic. All right. Well, thank you so much
for giving
your time, and I hope we can continue this conversation at a future time.
All right, no problem. All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
And that was Holly Cooper. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. She gave me a lot of new things to think about, some threads to follow, and I hope she did that for you too. Thank you for joining me, and if just a bit of housekeeping. If you want to help out the show, you can always join our Patreon campaign. Just go to my Twitter @Gabriel_Montoya, or I believe you can go to the Next Round Boxing Show, or TNR, @TNR Boxing Show, and the Patreon should be pinned there at the top. Anything helps to keep shows like this going. If you like this, we've also got the Next Round Boxing Show on Mondays, 4 p.m. Pacific Time, through we go about 2 hours. It's me and Steve Kim. Obviously, if you're listening to this show, you know the show. Talking all things boxing, previewing and reviewing all the fight action of every weekend. So also, you have on Wednesdays, myself and David Duenas, sometimes Dave solo, sometimes Dave with a different co-host on the original radio show on this network, Leave It in the Ring. So for everyone here at the Leave It in the Ring radio network, I'm Gabriel Montoya, and this is The Undiscovered Country.
These days, good sense is in short supply. Amid the fear-mongering and fake news, it can be hard to take a breath and tune in to what's real. But every week, The Economist provides clarity on the issues that matter to you. Get a free print copy of The Economist. Visit economist.com/free copy for a sensible, more considered view. Visit economist.com/free copy now. The Economist. Clear thinking in an uncertain world. New subscribers only. Terms and conditions apply.